Thank you. Well, it's very good to be here. I have a hoarseness that has set in, and I hope you all can hear me. I'm doing the best I can. I feel great, but my voice is gone from all of the talking this past week and even before. At times like these of democratic transitions, people call on folks like me to talk about what happened and what's going to happen and, you know, what should happen and what's next and all of these things. So I've been talking and talking and talking, and I'm pleased to now be speaking with you. This is my first time in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I interned when I was most of your ages in the summer of 1999 at the Detroit Free Press for the summer. And I'd never ventured any farther north than, I guess, Oakland County that summer, but I did learn about Upers and the Upper Peninsula. And when I found out that Professor Christensen was here and interested in perhaps having me come and speak, I really wanted to work hard to get here sooner rather than later, because I think it's very important to go around and see all the different ways in which we live in the United States of America. And so it's very good to be up here. The people have been very nice, and I'm glad to have a conversation with you all. The purpose of this discussion today is to help especially undergraduates think about the way our constitutional life together is framed, is changed, and moves on and up. We have a long-standing constitutional order in this country. It is the foundation of our law. The fundamental law of the land, as you all know, is the Constitution. And the Constitution itself is a function of a political process that followed a revolution and an experimental government with an Articles of Confederation. And finally, in 1787, we pretty much cemented the document today that's been amended relatively few times, 26 times, and we're left here with our Constitution. Now, everybody is affected by the Constitution in our country. Even some people not in the country are affected by the Constitution. The whole question, for example, over what we call birthright citizenship comes up. Does the 14th Amendment, which was passed after the Civil War, for example, mandate that people visiting in the country who happen to have a baby, that the baby be an American citizen? Well, we've taken that to mean, this doesn't a yes, but the fact of the matter is there is a legal argument that some scholars and judges believe that that's not what the 14th Amendment really meant. That the 14th Amendment was meant to give former slaves the full rights and privileges and process, substantive process of citizens, which they did not have as a matter of the fundamental law. In fact, slaves were three-fifths of a person. So we have to amend the Constitution. So there's a view that the 14th Amendment is really just about black people in the first place. But it can be expanded. The meaning can be interpreted properly or improperly over time to mean different things, or to place limits on different things, or to expand different things. And it's all a function of politics. And I say that to elevate the constitutional discussion. Politics is how we talk about problems to be resolved. It's often how we frame our legal questions when we wind up in a litigation situation. So many of our constitutional rights are a product of lawsuits, quite frankly. You all have probably heard of Brown versus Board of Education, and that was a 1954 Supreme Court decision, which was unanimous, involving the separate schools, segregated schooling, and inferior resources that were not allocated fairly across large parts of the country. And so the political moorings got going, and after about 30 years of the NAACP, finally they got this big victory in Brown versus Board of Education. And to this day, there's a longstanding project of school desegregation and integration and diversity, and a lot of things that are yet forming and reforming, resolving and falling apart. And again, it all goes back to our ongoing conversation to decide how, as a people, with majority rule and minority rights, we are to define these issues and then eventually to resolve them. And so I'm lifting up some examples. Again, I want you to understand, especially as undergraduates, the empowerment that the people are given in our republic to shape where it is we go, not just in the electoral process, but in the legal process too. I have some examples, and these are hot button, hot button type examples. You know what I mean by hot button. Like, they're controversial, impolite, things we often don't talk about. You know, one reason I became a scholar, Professor Christensen, is the same reason I was a journalist before. I like to fight, I like to write, and I like to meddle in other people's business, which means you get to talk about a lot of impolite things. Like, you know, we talk about racial profiling, don't we? Racial profiling. What is racial profiling? Who knows? Okay, good. That's fine. I mean, you know, racial profiling. And so in practice, we generally think of it in terms of policing. That's how it came into the... Dr. Cornell West informed the Reverend Al Sharpton in the 90s that certain police forces interrogated people, whether there was a crime or not, based on factors like race. So it came to be called racial profiling. It became a huge issue. All these reactive legal scholars started writing about it. Oh, this is unconstitutional. It's violating people's Fourth Amendment right. Then there are searches. All that. But, you know, the problem is, you know, again, I sat back and thought, well, is that really racial profiling? It seemed to me actual profiling as a law enforcement mechanism got really big around 1980 when the FBI, in a string of child killings in Atlanta of young black kids, adolescent boys and young teens, these black kids were disappearing and being drowned and everything. And the police couldn't figure out who was doing it. And there was a fear that it was a white supremacist doing it. But they were always disappearing in black neighborhoods, in black communities. Like a mother would drive up and send her son to the store. He wouldn't come back. And somehow he was gone and dead. And so eventually the FBI had to figure out, who's doing this? And they've used profiling. They said, this has to be a person who can pass, or persons, who can pass within that community and go without notice, which means you're basically up to rule out white folks in Atlanta in 1980. So profiling was good and worked, and they nabbed the killer, and he's in jail now, Wayne Williams. That's profiling, okay? See, I think what we did lately in the rush to correct things, we wound up maybe just renaming racism racial profile. There, if you just pull me over in the parking lot out here, me, I'm black, and start questioning me over burglaries in Sault Ste. Marie just because I'm black, that's not racial profiling, that's just racism. That we've been dealing with that issue in America. Let's deal with that separately. Don't give racial profiling a bad. So I got to write an article where I was promoting racial profiling. But I have to define it the correct way first. Because, see, if you start down the wrong road, constitutionally and legally, you can end up with a lot of bad results. So how you define these things matters up front. You know, now after it's been 20 years, sometimes it's hard to get people's attention. What's supposed to be up here, and I'll go back to the slides, but I had linked on, and it's just the title of a recent article that I wrote that you might want to look at from 2013, and it's titled, The Corrective Use of Lawsuit Data in Policing. Reconstructing the vocabulary of racial profiling, where I try to explain so much of what, you know, we're attaching the label of racial profiling to gives racial profiling, which is inherently good, a bad name because it's actually just racism. And there are remedies at law for that. Real racial profiling can help us to stop a serial killer from nabbing these youths from these convenience stores and drowning them in the Chattahoochee River. Or on the other side, remember the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995? Oh, you weren't born. But Spencer remembers the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995. The federal building blew up, all those people, scores of people dead. And so the government had to decide, well, who could have done this? So when you do racial profiling, you think, okay, who, you know, what group is more likely to blow stuff up? You know, somebody who probably had explosives training. Maybe a police officer, a veteran, somebody with a grievance against the government. And so you do all of this and you develop a profile. And it's usually, you know, it would be a disaffected white person. And you can narrow it. And they found Timothy McVeigh and he was convicted, you know. So there is maybe some stereotyping involved. But when you're dealing in data and some qualitative experience, in the furtherance of the public interest, that may be allowable, especially if it's working. So, I mean, it's there are no bright lines here. That's what makes constitutionalizing things fun. But I think the way we approach these things and the comfort level with some uncomfortable practices, the more we can get comfortable just talking openly and honestly about these things, the more problems we can solve, and maybe the more common ground we know that we have as a people. So let's go back to the slides and go to the second of the three contexts, just by way of fun examples that I have chosen to highlight here. And that next one is just this idea of discrimination. That's the second one. Now, I have a link that you're really not supposed to see. That is a link to a CNN. You were supposed to get 4 minutes of video at this point of something that happened in North Carolina that's become very famous. I'm going to click to see whether it comes on. And it looks like it. I'm going to F5 this and see whether that'll bring up the video. It won't. Well, it was a video of Attorney General Loretta Lynch and her response to a legislatively enacted statute in North Carolina. You've heard of the bathroom bill, right? Okay, so in North Carolina, the state legislature was called into special session. So the city of Charlotte passed an ordinance, a civil rights ordinance, that included, I think it was to allow persons to use the bathrooms of their choice and with regard to whatever gender they claim to be. So the city of Charlotte passes the ordinance. The state of North Carolina comes into special session, and the legislature passes the bill, and Governor McCrory signs a bill that repeals that and that requires people to go to the restroom of their birth identity, birth-identified gender. So then you've heard the rest, right? Everybody's boycotting North Carolina. The NCAA got involved, and of course we know the NCAA is the most morally progressive organization. So they came in and decided, you know, they're going to go against North Carolina. And we have all these problems now with North Carolina getting pushback because of this discriminatory law. So Loretta Lynch, the video shows Loretta Lynch giving a press conference and announcing the Department of Justice will be suing North Carolina. North Carolina sued them first over the regulation that they felt was a violation of the Constitution and the separation of powers and federalism issues. But she said, you know, we're going to go after you, North Carolina, and we might even withhold funding from the University of North Carolina because of what you have done with this bill. No more money for the North Carolina. And Loretta Lynch is a native of North Carolina. So you have this clash, and she gave this one of the most, probably the most sweeping and the most, no matter how you feel about her position, the most courageous, I would say, because it was really, I think, out there. But one of the most courageous speeches ever given as to this new issue, and the new issue is the transgender issue. There was no such thing as the transgender issue 20 years ago. There just wasn't. It was not a political. But President Obama is the first president ever to mention. And so it comes in what discourse? Civil rights. Civil rights. Now, the last time I remember an attorney general wagging a finger at the state, at a southern state, over laws was, I don't even remember because I wasn't born, but I've seen the footage on Eyes on the Prize, the PBS series documenting the civil rights movement. And that was Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy having to deal with a lot of intransigent, recalcitrant southern governors who Martin Luther King would have described as having lips dripping with the rhetoric of nullification and interposition. So now here comes Loretta Lynch 50 years later, and she's wagging a finger of her own. And the question has to be, well, discrimination. You know, so is this the kind of discrimination that should be promoted? Or should it be constitutionalized and made illegal and actionable, like race or religion or national origin, those things already protected by statute, by federal statute, and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That is a political question that has to be resolved, I would argue, through political processes, whether they break down or not. That's certainly what Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement did. They filed lawsuits, but first and foremost, they had to explain, articulate to, and persuade the dominant majority population that what they wanted should be A, term civil rights, and B, put at least in some statutes pursuant to the powers of the protections of the 14th Amendment. So we have other issues, things that where discrimination was okay. And by the way, we discriminate against a lot of different types of groups. We discriminate against any. Our criminal code is a function of discrimination, you know, in the broadest sense. But in terms of invidious discrimination that violates people's basic rights, that is something that will be open to negotiation. And so you have to go through a particular process. So you have the executive branch, and the president does matter. This particular president is regarded, again, as the first to use the term transgender publicly. And then you have the people like North Carolina's legislature, and I guess the citizens, too, because they returned all those people to power just now. There's still super majorities of the party for that in North Carolina. You have to deal with that. And so who wins? Well, often these questions wind up having to be resolved at the Supreme Court of the United States. And that's one of the reasons you have this huge fight over that seat that would flip the court from being a more conservative court on social issues to being a more liberal court on social issues. That's why you have this huge, that's why this election was so big going in. A lot of money spent on making sure that people who had a vested interest in these particular issues would have their voices heard. And then finally, you know, that leads into this transgender concern and what's happening in North Carolina leads into this religious freedom stuff. You know, y'all remember Governor Pence in the Indiana Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the others like it. Well, we had a federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act in the early 90s. As I recall, it passed and not a single person voted against it in the entire Congress, or at least in the Senate. And so now they're the state ones, and they're designed to protect, ostensibly to protect churches from having to change their doctrine no matter what goes on in the civil realm with these new rights that are being brought up in protections. And so you have this new tension between that which is religious freedom. Now, what's the opposition to them? Well, people who are on the what would be called the more progressive side of 14th Amendment interpretations and civil rights, the definition of what will be civil rights and what won't be, they argue that the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts are really just licenses to discriminate. Which, by the way, churches and mosques and synagogues already have in the First Amendment. The First Amendment is supposed to protect churches. They can do whatever they want to in hiring and firing. But now there are new questions as to public accommodations. If at your church you have the symphony concert and you are a public accommodation, there are some states like Iowa where they're saying, well, if you have doctrine that does not fit with the civil law, you are a discriminatory organization and you may not have these functions anymore. You know, and there are tax exemption issues in play. So the whole question of what religious freedom is now suddenly contested after all these years. It had been settled law, and how does it happen? Through the political process. When people become politically empowered, they can speak up. You all do know that women did not have the right to vote until the 19th Amendment came, around 1920. And so how does the constitutional amendment take place? The Constitution had to be amended to give women the right to vote. And Susan B. Anthony died long before that amendment passed. She was a major suffragette, but she would not live to see the Constitution amended to allow women to vote. Well, if women can't vote, and how do women get the right to vote? Anybody ever think about that? Again, the idea is new rights being asserted, starting in a political process and finding their way into the fundamental law of the land. And a constitutional amendment is the most secure way to make those rights permanent and enduring and very clear. A Supreme Court decision can be overturned. Brown versus Board of Education was nice, but it was just undoing the damage of Plessy versus Ferguson 58 years later that overturned the 14th Amendment with regard to black people. So you can put all your faith in a court decision, but they can just... Capital punishment was unconstitutional for 4 years in the 70s until it wasn't. The Supreme Court just reversed itself, just get some new judges. But if you amend the Constitution, it's not so easy. How did women get the right to vote? Well, they didn't amend the Constitution, did it? They couldn't vote. What did women have to do to get the right to vote? Right! That's exactly, they have to get the men to get on board. And how do you do that? The political process, personal appeals. It's certainly not fair, but there was no other way. So they did, and it worked, and women got the right to vote. You know, that's the way it is. Martin Luther King certainly understood that. He went out and, you know, preached sermons to America so people would change their mind, and they did. People have to die as well. You know, it's not lost on me that the major legal accomplishment of the civil rights movement, which is widely regarded to be the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is what essentially bars all forms of racial segregation in most contexts in America, for that to be passed, there had to be a lot of political agitation and sacrifice. And what I'm told was the straw that broke the camel's back and that put public opinion on the side of that law was when the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed on a Sunday morning between Sunday school and church, and four black adolescent girls lost their lives in a church bomb. And it took decades for the bombers to be brought to justice. And that's when the United States Congress decided this cannot keep happening. But people have to die, and the families, they just sacrificed, and that's what happened. That's the price of progress. Somebody has to pay it. It happened again the very next year. President Johnson told Martin Luther King, well, here's your Civil Rights Act. I've used all my political capital. It's done. And Dr. King turned and said, well, good. So now we need the Voting Rights Act, and we need the Voting Rights Act because there are only 300 blacks in Mississippi registered to vote, and the state is 30% black. There are all kinds of intimidation and litigation. We need a Voting Rights Act. And President Johnson said, are you crazy? I just used every ounce of political capital that I have to get you this Civil Rights Act that y'all have been marching for, this March on Washington that embarrassed us, and now you think, forget it. And King said, fine, we go to Alabama. Did anybody see Selma, the movie? That's what happened next. They knew that they were going to get beat down on the bridge and get beat up, and that people might even die when they left those churches after church and went to the bridge and got beat up. And that was it. And after that, Lyndon Johnson said to the majority leader, I want you to send me the darndest, strongest Voting Rights Act that you can get through. And that happened. So the political process matters with regard to civil rights. So before we go attaching the civil rights label onto the next thing, I mean, next is going to be animals. I mean, the way I see it is everybody wants to turn everything into a compelling rights regime. But you have to be careful before you do that, because there's a whole lot of history and real struggle and real oppression that predated the appellation, if you will, of this particular constitutional problem and its resolution. So be careful the language that you use or that you allow to be used. So, my point here, constitutional competitions are political. And again, I use the term political to elevate the conversation, because we're a country of popular sovereignty. We basically believe in majority rule. If we didn't believe in majority rule, we would be apartheid South Africa or the Soviet Union under Gorbachev or Khrushchev or all of those people. So we, for better or for worse, that's what we're dealing with. So in the political process, we have a 230-year-old process where we get along and correct ourselves. Apartheid fell in part because the United States boycotted the state of South Africa. The United States corrected all of its original sins through internal self-correction. And that's the power of politics. And by the way, Martin Luther King was 26 when he first got involved in his first pastorate in Montgomery. And was 39 when he died. It was frequently very young people who helped to move things forward. One reason that so many women were so animated by and inspired by the Hillary Clinton candidacy is that when she was a very young woman, as a Wellesley College senior, she was given the privilege, presumably by her classmates at that all-women's liberal arts college outside Boston, of delivering the commencement address. And before it was fashionable and before you could go on Facebook Live and show the world how progressive you were, she went to the stage and told all. She got the whole lineup told for ignoring the concerns of her generation of career-minded young women moving in to break barriers. And many, many, many women in particular found that to be courageous. And then she went and broke the glass ceiling at a very old white shoe law firm when she made partner at the Rose Law Firm of Little Rock, I believe, in 1978. So, you know, it's the younger people often who look at the world and say, why not? And who challenge us to look and frame things in new ways, and who form new coalitions. The women's groups were often aligned with the black groups. One of the funny stories of the civil rights movement is when the bus boycott started in 54, all of the blacks in the town of Montgomery, which is half African American, decided they weren't going to take the buses. They were going to protest the ill treatment of Rosa Parks and others, and it went for about a year. But a lot of the poorer black women worked for wealthier whites in their homes. We called it day work, ironing, attending to the children, cooking, cleaning. And a lot of the wealthier white women would provide transportation. They would see the blacks walking to work and pick them up. And a lot of the men were getting upset because that was really encouraging the boycott. So you had a kind of tacit endorsement that happened. And I have to believe that that helped to make things change as well. I have some resources up here, just three articles that I think can help you if you want to learn more about this. There's nothing new about the discourse, the discursive question here, and how that affects our discussions of rights and our political activity that leads to constitutional interpretation and reinterpretation. But I would just suggest that you look to some of these resources if you want to know more about how people bigger than me view these things and how they've been framed since long before I was on the scene. It leads to the question, excuse me, can a model of constitutional populism, given everything that I just went through, just a snapshot of various constitutional controversies and impasses, which is what we have in North Carolina, by the way, elections matter, the new Attorney General probably won't be suing the state of North Carolina, where Loretta Lynch was in process with that. Can a model of constitutional populism, that is where we involve and give voice to what people are doing, most people, can that resolve these kinds of disputes that I've gone through in political and or judicial processes? My controversial answer has been for at least a decade, yes. I had to when I learned about populist theory in the writings of Richard Parker, who was my criminal law professor, I had to go back and reread American history to understand that the revolution itself, and the revolution is why we're so different. It's why we're not Canada. They're still under the crown, technically. They are. Australia, too. We're not. And our revolution itself, we have to come together and decide, no more, we will declare independence and we will fight. And people have to come to agreement on that, and there have to be buy-in. And it worked. And the world has never been the same. Fast forward to the civil rights movement. I used to think when I studied political science in college that it was federal judges who saved the race. That's kind of the trope here, the federal judges saved the court. Go. You're a civil rights lawyer, and you'll say that, well, you know what? You know, I have to go back and read and figure out, how did Martin Luther King do this? How did RFK do this? How did Lyndon B. Johnson? How did even Richard Nixon do it? It's funny, President Nixon was more anti-segregation at first than John F. Kennedy was in the 50s. So you have to reread that, too, and figure out, well, what made JFK change. Those black votes. Yeah. And so here we have the elephant in the room. Here we have the elephant in the room. Race, the election, OMG, right? By the way, I wrote this before the election. And so the election just gave me room for a new slide. This is the last slide. Okay, so what do you have if you turn on the TV? You hear, oh, the rural racist white people put Donald Trump in there. First of all, in my theory, I'm going to be honest, even if that were true, which it's not, I can prove it, but even if that were true, then if you're in a democracy and you can't deal with the majority, then leave. Okay, because that's what you, otherwise we're going to do minority rule from New York. Raise your hand if you've lived in New York City before. Thank you. So, you know, my feeling is, you know, that's not true. We need to branch out a bit and look at who votes. You know, who voted? What happened? Is it legitimate? And what I think is interesting is, this: you have to look at the whole sweep of the campaign of 2016. Bernie Sanders on the left turned out and involved a large portion of people, including white rural people in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio, who came out and voted, young people, who came out and voted. Donald Trump opened up the process, and a lot of people who were disaffected registered, got involved and voted. I thought, and I'll just say I'm a Democrat, I thought that we wanted more people involved in politics in America. That's what I thought. I thought that we believed in power to the people, all the people, not just people who might agree with Nancy Pelosi, but all the people. So what happened was you have the Trump growth and you have the Bernie growth, and then you wound up with Senator Clinton after a very close primary, relatively close primary process, and then Donald Trump, who just ran right over everybody. I mean, just tied that thing up, was spending very little money to do it. And so, you know, you have these two candidates who are very different, and in the final analysis, you wound up with what I'm calling, again, you know, do your own thinking here, read the numbers for you. I call it a massive multicultural coalition that Donald Trump put together. Again, I have to say, I don't want to be political, but so you listen, I am a different. So Donald Trump amassed a massive multicultural coalition. How? Well, the latest is, at least in North Carolina, 11% of black voters voted for Donald Trump. That's as well as any Republican. That's twice as many black votes, twice as a high percentage as Mitt Romney got 4 years ago. And almost as well as Ronald Reagan did in 1980 when he got 14%. Nationally, they're saying it was 8 or 9. We've got to wait for those numbers to come out. Donald Trump got 30% of Hispanic votes. 30%. But they don't talk about that on the TV. It's not convenient to the narrative of the white people in the Upper Peninsula who are in the Ku Klux Klan electing Trump. It's a lie. It's a lie. Now, 30% of Hispanics voted for Donald. And, I mean, let's be real. He was the hardest on Hispanics from the beginning. I mean, you know, and then he walked it back a bit. But 30%, and they gave him Florida. The Cuban Hispanic vote is believed to have helped him win Florida. It's not just Miami, it's also Tampa, which many people don't know. 42% of women voted for Donald Trump. They said that in her victory hall at the Javits Center in New York City, Secretary Clinton had a glass ceiling up there, and so she really started pushing the let's make history thing. Barack Obama never talked much about breaking a racial barrier. He talked about the historic nature of people getting involved and $25 donations or whatever it was, but there was rarely an overt appeal, let's make me the first black president. It turns people off. People just don't, Americans are not comfortable with that. People like to be primarily dealing in merit, if you will, I think. So 42% of women voted for Donald Trump. Donald Trump got rural folk. He got people who voted for Barack Obama. A lot of people voted for Barack Obama, turned around and voted for Donald Trump. He got the people who voted for Bernie Sanders, whose model was, we need somebody who's independent, without a super PAC, who tells people where to go. And if that's the way you vote, that may have been Bernie before and then Trump. So he got urban people, and of course he got all kinds of white folks, and he got people from across the country. I'm not extolling Donald Trump's victory, but I'm suggesting to you that there are possibilities if we understand the public and how they articulate their desires collectively, and then come back together along those lines. there's a moment here. If people would get off the view, this is a Ku Klux Klan administration for just a minute. Maybe, just maybe, if you consider that 42% of women, 30% of Hispanics, between 10 and 20% of blacks, people from all regions, Democrats, if you look at it differently, then maybe America can actually come together in an interesting way. I know it's a very inflammatory person. Donald Trump isn't. If he weren't inflammatory, he wouldn't have won. You know, there are trade-offs here. I was just on a radio show in San Diego, which is one of the reasons I was late. I gave these views, and they wanted me to talk more because they're so weird. So I had to take a little longer and develop them. And so I was a bit behind getting out here on stage. But, you know, that was a largely black and Hispanic audience, that particular show. And I wanted them to understand that what has to happen, particularly for people of color who think that somehow they were left out, to understand, no, Donald Trump would not have won that election without that black and Hispanic support and a substantial portion of black voters in the South who simply did not vote for either of them, like 140,000 black voters in North Carolina who voted for neither, very different from 2012. All of this matters because how we perceive ourselves as a people and as a political unit will always inform how we argue about the Constitution and about policy. There is no other way. So I am evangelical about my insistence that we step back, that we understand as much as possible the totality of history and the complications. As I said, Richard Nixon was better on civil rights than JFK for the longest. And then try to reimagine toward the future, which is what elections are about, some way forward together. It starts, though, with listening and interacting with each other more. And that's why I'm glad that Spencer Christensen invited me here to the Upper Peninsula. I know that you don't see very many people like me around here if I define myself as only a black person. Fortunately, I don't. I'm an American, and you are too. And I thank you for your time. I'll open the floor for questions. Or critiques, arguments, anger, rage. Yes. Wouldn't that be something? But you know, the problem with being is that's very kind of you. Donald Trump's shortlist for the Supreme Court. And you know, that's the thing. In fairness, I must, you know, he's made pledges to be very right-wing ideological on Supreme Court appointments. That helped him to get out his party and to have coattails, and he had, surprisingly, Donald Trump had coattails. So, you know, somebody like me, I'm a moderate. I am a true moderate. And I'm a Democrat, and there aren't many of us left. Most Democrats now tend to be very left-wing. I'm more a Bill Clinton-type Democrat. So what happens, I wind up, people like me are isolated. And I think we're going to be going back and forth more and more. That's why I was on the radio so long. They think the answer, the party, they think the answer is to go to the hard left. Is that really going to help them with Michigan? I know. You know, I'm from Kentucky. I'm like Spencer. I'm a native of Kentucky. Bill Clinton won Kentucky both times. A Democrat hasn't won Kentucky in the presidential election since, though we've had Democratic governors. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. excellent question. Moore talked about this morning. And he said, we now know against Bernie from the beginning, that if you read WikiLeaks. And he said that these people in Michigan, many of whom wound up, that you took, and people took away their candidate. And a lot of young people voted third party for Dr. Jill Stein or for Johnson. They got a lot of, that's a big reason Hillary got more votes than I think. But they weren't going to vote for either of them. We had an interesting thing here. Bernie probably would have won absent a terror attack against Trump. If there had been a terror attack, he would have lost. Because enough Americans get really scared over terrorism. And, you know, he's a little bit soft compared to other, rhetorically. You know, people don't want that on blood when something blows up in America. That's just the way it is. So barring no terror attack, which we didn't have, Bernie probably would have won, I think, even though most people are not socialists in our country and abhor socialism. But here's what I, here's why I disagree more, and that the further left you go, it, you know, racial categories and data still help. Black people are not that liberal. Black people are very religious and conservative in their churches, even though they vote for liberal people. That's why 140,000 blacks in North Carolina stayed home. You can go really hard left, but you will suppress the black vote. 14% of black men voted for Donald Trump. 14% of black men, even though Barack Obama got about 93 or 94% of the black vote nationwide in 08. So you have to moderate that. So if you didn't have this need, the Democrats cannot win without 86% or more of the black vote with very high black turnout. So you can go socialist, which blacks don't believe in. You know, you would not know, by the way, if you watched only the black people on the network, the cable news networks, because they choose black people. I have a running joke. It's sort of not politically correct, but I watch Rachel Maddow, and I really enjoy her show. She's a very liberal woman. She's a lesbian, and she articulates a lot of pro-LGBT views. That she's there. She's out of the closet. She has a doctorate from Oxford. She's, you know, I get mad at some of the stuff she's done, but I learn from her show. I like. But then why do they bring on Al Sharpton on Sunday morning, who's a black Baptist preacher, who also has white lesbian views? They put on a black person, but you got to have white lesbian views to get on the TV. Most black people don't think that way. They don't vote that way. So, I mean, that's the fallacy. You know, so what needs to happen is that there needs to be some kind of calibration. I'm not sure the Democratic Party can do it. Also, forget the Hispanic voters are traditional. 40% of them voted for Arnold Schwarzenegger during the California recall. There's this Democratic view that if you just bring in all these people who aren't white, then the Democrats are going to have a huge majority. Well, people don't vote like black people. Black people are the most loyal Democratic voting people ever since the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that's coming to a grinding halt now because the current black president, I have an article from last Thursday where I called the election. It came out in the Harvard Law Record last Thursday. You can Google it. And I pointed out that Hillary Clinton's going to lose this election. And I pointed out how Loretta Lynch came down there, and when she threatened the University of North Carolina, there are five historically black public colleges and universities in North Carolina that are on the financial edge, and they will close if Barack Obama decides that he's going to advance transgender issues at the expense of black people's issues. And that's one of the reasons that Democrats did not get North Carolina. So they can go left if they want to, and just watch that Senate and House go all the way over, and Donald Trump and Mike Pence. Be my guest. And I'm a Democrat, but you know nobody asked Amos Jones, you know, except Spencer. Who's next? More? Yes. So that's the case of Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School, which is a school in Michigan. I can't recall where in Michigan, but it seems like it was central Michigan. And they had a school teacher in the church school who was commissioned as a minister teacher for the school. I think it was a preschool. And she had problems with narcolepsy. She was falling asleep all the time. So she requested a medical accommodation and was missing a lot of work. And they fired her for not being able to do the job. And she sued for discrimination. See, I said, discrimination. So she sued for discrimination based on her medical stuff. And the first place you go if you're suing under the particular federal statute where that's covered is you have to go to the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is a bureaucratic agency that's written into the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And the reason that you have to go there first is so that parties can amicably resolve their cases for at least 6 months without just running into federal court first. So she went there, and generally the rule is you can't go after a church. You know, you're a minister, you're an employee of that faith. That is an internal decision. Churches are allowed to discriminate. We do it all the time. I mean, in fact, religion is inherently discriminatory and authoritarian by definition. There are people who are in and people who are out. If your religion is not discriminating, you're not in a religion. I'm sorry. One way or the other, you know. The existence of hell is a very discriminatory thing with consequences for people who believe in hell, which are a whole lot of people. So there she is filing suit. And in the old days, the First Amendment, a court would say, you're out. The First Amendment says that if we as a court decide this issue of ecclesiastical division, we have interfered in your church spiritual affairs. We won't do that no matter how, you know, we don't do that. In fact, a church can decide no blacks. Some churches passed policies like that in the South in the 60s, where they said, we will not accept black members. And I thought, by the way, footnote, I thought, what an awful thing for a Baptist church in the South to decide, how could they do this? Well, I found out part of the reason the churches, I'm not apologizing for invidious race discrimination, but I learned a little-known secret of the civil rights movement reading a thesis of a senior at Emory University in religion. A bunch of blacks had started having kneel-ins where they basically disrupted black church services. And that was very short-lived because religion is so sacred. You don't bother that, even among the kingdom. And so they stopped. But I think that's probably when the white churches started saying, no, if black people come here, we know they have churches that are bigger and better than ours. This is a ploy. So they started passing. That's one of the reasons. So what happened with Hosanna Tabor? Barack Obama's EEOC decided, aha, we're going to sue the church. Let's see how far we can do the, you know, this tension between religious freedom and discrimination. Let's test this. And the court, the church lost. They were going to have to pay her money or reinstate her, those offerings and tithes. And, you know, her narcolepsy would have to be accommodated. They appealed, the church school appealed. And the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati, the 3-judge panel, decided, they can be sued. The First Amendment does not lawsuit. Now, class, or folk, audience, 20 years ago, that would have been all out of bounds. Again, politics matters. It would have been all out of bounds. So they took it to the Supreme Court of the United States. 8-0 lost. EEOC beat down, out of court, can't do it. Violation of religious freedom under the Constitution. 8-0. And you know what? It's a darn shame that the EEOC, I have 25 cases in front of the EEOC right now for women, blacks, white women, white men, all kinds, and can't get anywhere. But they can go sue a church, though. That's a problem. That's all. But see, that was a test out of Michigan. And it almost worked because the intermediary court agreed that they could be sued and have to pay and reinstate her. And they could tell a church what to do with regard to discipline of a minister. That's completely anti-American in my reading of the Constitution. And all of the justices who decided this, I think Elena Kagan had to recuse herself because she was the Solicitor General or something when Barack Obama's government decided they were going to try to take this church down. So, you know, they did it again 2 weeks ago. They sued the Salvation Army over not giving someone a job. The Salvation Army is a church. It's classified as a church. The Salvation Army denied a man employment for a cognitive disability or disorder. And so they're now at it again. And so, you know, I told you the demography. Most blacks are, frankly, conservative religious people who happen to vote Democratic. And you know how black people are with church. Don't mess with the church. If you had messed with our churches, there would have been no civil rights movement. You could argue that that was a Baptist movement. If you read the history, it was always run out of independent churches operating very much on their own, according to what they said that they were told by their deity. That's why Martin Luther King was a pastor and all of his lieutenants. And you had Reverend Charles Hill, in Michigan at Hartford Avenue Baptist Church who operated exactly the same. So this is a tension in this the Democratic thing. It is a combustible coalition that the Democrats have pulled together. And the more they make it, I thought I would never say this, the more they make it about identity, your little box that you check, I think that that spells disaster, and I really think that the millennials are over it. You know, and that's what progress is supposed to do, where you don't forget the history, but you're looking at a new paradigm where the first thing you define yourself as is not as a white lady or whatever, or a Latina. That was healthy for a while, but I think that that heuristic is crumbling, and it's probably a healthy thing. More questions? I promise not to spend that long, but that was a Supreme Court case. Yes. It's believed that he won. I called it for Trump, but I think it's still technically considered undecided. Has anybody heard the latest? I think there's still ballots absentee. What's the latest? Still undecided. But he's ahead by, the last I heard this morning, 10,000 votes. The reason that it's so close. You know, you all, we forget because the media, which I've been part of and watched, they always leave out a very important fact here that made this election really strange. You had a lawyer candidate who indirectly ordered that BlackBerry's be smashed and evidence destroyed after a subpoena was issued. Now, I was a huge Hillary supporter in 08 against Barack all the way till the end. I think that she is the most tragic political figure in the history of America because 08 was really her year. She got more votes than Barack Obama did in the primary. It was the caucuses that put him over. The feminists turned on her. She should have had every feminist vote, in my opinion. And oh, if you're a true feminist and you want to break a glass ceiling, then the gender should matter. And you should have voted for her in 08 before she corrupted herself. Now, I'm not here to give a political speech. This is fact. That foundation took all that money and she did all those and raised $18 million for herself in 80 speeches. And it's a tragedy because she didn't want a Rolls Royce. She had to take that money because Citizens United made it where it cost Barack Obama $1 billion to run in 2012, and it cost Mitt Romney $1 billion to run. How are you going to get that money when you've been railing against corporations? Well, you have to look to the international foreign powers and run a racket between the Clinton Foundation and the State Department with Huma as the liaison. That's what you had to do. So we're looking at a deeply flawed person who 8 years ago really wasn't, unless you're going to go back to so-called Travelgate and those made-up scandals. So she's tragic because she really, and she, the study shows she would have gotten more votes than Barack against John McCain in 08. And I believe she would have had a better grasp of how to run the government, and she wouldn't have killed the, she wouldn't have destroyed the Democratic majority by lurching so far leftward the way Barack Obama did, because she, I think she's a more moderate person, or at least understands America a little bit more, because she was not raised in Indonesia and Hawaii. She was raised in Chicago, Illinois. And that informs what you think you can get by with, in my opinion. And then the public would have known Barack better, and no one would have been saying he was born in Kenya. He'd probably be about to be inaugurated in a 12-year Democratic reign. So the other tragedy is she just got more votes again and lost. What a tragedy. So it's hard to say what Bernie did, what Trump did, when you have the elephant in the room that our networks often don't focus on unless it's Fox News, and that is a foundation figure and a speech-giving money hoarder and a BlackBerry with email subpoena on it destroyer standing up there about to be the number one legal person in our country. Now, we can talk about the dirtbag ways of Donald Trump, too. The only problem is that's all in a private business realm. You know, I mean, it's a very different situation from being in an official capacity dealing with these. So that hurt her. So, you know, I don't know. It's hard to answer what would have happened because she is such a... There were so many reasons to vote against her in the end. And I hate to say that because she's one of my heroes. Do you have a reaction? Yeah. What? The class of protest vote. Let me just say, I believe you have closed primaries here. That is, in order to vote for Bernie, you have to be a registered Democrat. Is that true? Or was it an open primary? Open primary. Okay, so that makes even more legitimate this theory that perhaps Bernie, you know, if Bernie were the nominee, he might have won. I'm in North Carolina where I had to vote in the Democratic primary, which is a little, it skews what might happen, what your interpretations of what might happen later. So, I mean, that's, and again, what is that? What's the superdelegate primary? Well, it all comes down to money now. If you, Professor Christensen, decided, I'm going to run for Congress. No, I'm going to run for this. No, I'm going to run for governor of Michigan. Before anybody at the newspaper reads anything about Spencer's background, his life work, his accomplishments, his work here, anything, his past, his scandalous past in high school. I'm just kidding. There's no scandalous past. Very clean cut, he and his sister. If before they even look at that, what are they going to look at? Oh, there's no money. And then you're delegitimized. Money is synonymous with your value and your fitness to be a political leader now. So the superdelegates have to decide. So what would have happened if Secretary Clinton had won? The first thing she would have to do is start raising that $1 billion for 2020. That is the first item, just like every single member of Congress. Right now, except the independently wealthy ones who bankroll their own campaigns, who are few and far between, the first thing you have to do is get on that phone and beg for money. And that's one thing I actually enjoyed about Donald Trump in the primary. He would just call people out. Nikki Haley, Governor of South Carolina, said negative things about me. He said, oh, that's a shame that Governor Haley doesn't like me, because she came to my office to beg for money, and she was very bold about it. That's called compromise, being compromised. See, Bernie wasn't compromised. Neither was Trump. So I believe a lot of Bernie people. I want to know. I want them to do a story on the Bernie people who voted for Trump, just like the black people who voted for Trump. But we'll probably never hear about it because it disrupts the narrative, because it was those people. It was the Alabama Klan crowd and the people in Michigan who blamed blacks who did this to America. That's the narrative. Who had their hand up? Okay. Uh-huh. So here's an excellent example of how, and really what is a non-controversial these days, a non-controversial resolution of a problem. And the problem was our mobility-impaired citizens not being able to get around like everybody else because of cobblestone or because there are five stairs, it looks pretty, and no ramp. So what did we do? A political activity happened, and people went to their lawmakers and said, look, you know, my child is in the school in kindergarten and can't get the scooter up. There needs to be something, and it doesn't just need to be charitable. There needs to be the force of law to make this happen in a public place. My children are part of the public, too. So they passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. And what that does is that requires, in the first instance, as you know, institutions, public accommodations, places to proactively comply. And when they don't, there are often private rights of action that the statutes give. The beauty of statutes, disability community, the disabled community has not been constitutionalized per se, any more than we're all subject to basic constitutional rights and protections as citizens, equal protection of law. We all have that. But the nice thing about statutes is, again, after I reread American history because of Richard Parker's instruction in law school, I realized that's more enduring than if a court were to decide 5-4 that there should be vamps. The fact that the legislature comes together and says, hey, we should build ramps and make and monitor this, and maybe send testers to make sure that these entities that say they're compliant really are. That's how those rights are taken care of. Statutorily, and again, overriding it all, are basically the statute comes under the authority of things like the 14th Amendment. So there are those protections. Now, you don't have affirmative action, per se, that is a compelling state interest for disabled people, the way you do for race and gender. You don't have it for sexual orientation or gender identity either. Because once you start deciding that there will be some benefits that are beyond the norm, then you got to show a real compelling state interest. Now, I could see where that could happen for the disabled eventually. And in fact, schools and places voluntarily will look at that as a factor that enhances the diversity of the community to have different voices. And you're presumed to have a particular perspective when you've been operating in a mobility impaired circumstance. You know, so it's that. And the awareness factor is the big thing. And raising the awareness is the first step. That, again, is a political activist thing that happens. Then you get some legislation. Every now and then there will be a backlash. There hasn't been much of a backlash over accommodating disabled people. Here, and then Spencer Christensen. Yes, up here. It's much harder. The Obergefell decision is the gay marriage decision, the 5-4 Supreme Court decision that mandated same-sex marriage. The problem with that is it's 5-4. If you had a really conservative justice, it would go the other way. And it will be relitigated because it's not in the Constitution per se. It is an interpretation. So, I mean, given that Donald Trump said that he wants justices like Scalia, if he's telling the truth and does that, then it will go the other way as soon as not his current replacement is done, because this is Scalia's replacement. But it's something like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it's thought he might retire. Something that flips the balance. I think it'll be relitigated and it'll go the other way. And the only reason that they would take away those rights, we're told once you give a right like health care, you can't take it away. That's not true. The problem with Obergefell was it's so counter-majoritarian. There were 36 states in a row that where people went out and voted against gay men, the people themselves. In North Carolina, which is not a backwater place, in 2012, there was already a statute banning gay marriage, and there was a constitutional amendment that the people voted on, and 61% of voters voted to amend the state constitution to ban gay marriage. In Kentucky, it was 82% in 2004. And Ohio, it was real high. Michigan did it. Even in California in 2008, Barack Obama won. But California voted in that proposition to ban gay marriage. A couple of states later on, like Maryland and I think Washington State or Oregon, went for it. But that was long after these other 36 to 38, were clearly against it. So see, you have the problem of public opinion. That matters as well. So I think Obergefell was in tension before, as far as I'm concerned, before there was a Republican president elect. There are some serious problems that people have with that, as evident in the most extreme thing you can do, which is to amend your constitution. To my knowledge, there was never a southern state uprising in the 50s where they wanted to go amend their constitution to ban integration. They tried everything else, but they didn't constitutionalize it. That is very serious. And a lot of black people vote that issue. They vote against it. The black vote made the difference. Blacks in California voted for Obama in 08, and they voted against gay marriage, and that's why it was banned. It was that sliver of the electorate that went the other. People don't like to talk about it. They tried to pretend it didn't happen at first. Because it's so inconvenient to people on the left that your most radical stalwart group, the blacks, are not that radical after all. That people don't want to deal with that. But it's just true. You know, I mean, it's just true. Survey research counts. The real vote tells you something. So I don't know what's going to happen to Obergefell, but it's more, it's less settled than people would have you believe on the television, that's for sure. Yes, Spencer. Sure. Well, it might not. You know, I'm not politically correct because I'm a scholar. See, I mean, you know, I was on that radio show a week ago. He said, Professor Jones, tell the people to vote. It would be a travesty for black people not to vote after what people went through. I said, no, not. I have a brother who does not vote. One of my brothers does not vote because he's believed for years and has been correct. It's a rigged system and nothing will change his situation. And he's correct. Nobody cares about him and his issues. He's exactly right. Likewise, I remember sitting in that same class in criminal law with Richard Parker, who changed my life, the great professor. And there was a kid from Notre Dame who had a whole lot of money. He had gone to Notre Dame. And, you know, he was sort of like a fraternity person, one of those. And, you know, we were talking about voting. He said, let's be honest here. I don't vote. And half the people in this room don't vote because we know that whoever gets in, we're fine. So to a millennial who doesn't vote, you know, you may have a point. Your vote might not matter. If you were a Florida A&M in 2000 University, your vote might have gotten thrown in the trash can by Catherine Harris. That can happen too. But you know what? You can make a difference. What you should do is try to arrange yourself and your friends to where your vote does count and matter, where your voice is heard. You're fortunate if you're a millennial and if you're a college-age millennial where you may not have children and obligations. My brother has 7 children and is divorced. He doesn't have time to organize. But you do. So, you know, my vote doesn't count. Well, okay, that could be true, but don't be lazy about it. If you care, then do something. Because there's an interest group out there for everybody. And they can count, and they do count. The NAACP, the NRA. But I will say this. I've made this argument at Campbell University. And I think that this is applicable here in the Upper Peninsula. One thing that I resent more than anything else in our country today that I have come to understand is going on, that Michael Moore speaks to, that Bernie Sanders speaks to, that Donald Trump spoke to, and that Jesse Jackson spoke to. And that is, frankly, that poor white people have no advocate and no voice. As much as we blacks complain, you know that if something bad happens, there's at least going to be hell to pay on the 6 o'clock news. And there are going to be 40 loudmouth, angry members of Congress who are going to raise hell, if nothing else. They don't seem to sponsor any legislation these days. But at least they're going to raise hell. You're going to have Congressman John Conyers there still trying to get reparations studied. Poor white people don't have that, even though they're a substantial portion of our country. How does that happen? That's anti-democratic. But Jesse Jackson got those votes, which nobody wants to talk about. He got them in eastern Kentucky. He won the Michigan caucus. He's a Baptist minister. He talked about poverty. He, unlike President Obama, who never set foot in Kentucky, Jesse Jackson went there, and he swept those Appalachian counties in 84 and 88. And nobody wants to talk about it. So poor white people, there may not be an interest group for you. And by the way, just, you know, the white supremacist groups are not really interest groups. They're not helping. They're not advancing a policy, really. You know, I mean, they may be social organizations, but you know, I'm talking about Greenpeace, NAACP, Lambda. There are all these organizations. So, you know, maybe I'm out of touch by suggesting that there's an organization for people, disaffected millennials up here, to plug into. And maybe there needs to be. You know, Martin Luther King tried to. They shot him. But what was his project where he got shot? He was there for the Poor People's Campaign, where he was taking it beyond just black people in the South, and they were going to deal with the issue of poor people. Our veterans, many of whom are poor. How does this happen? So I would say to the millennials, you know, you may have to even carve your own path. But there's power in numbers. And don't be fooled by the TV. If you watch too much TV, you would think that there are no poor white people. Because they're not on there. They're not on the TV. Anywhere at all, period. So you, I'm telling the truth. We all know it's the truth. So, you know, I understand that my vote doesn't count. It's probably true much of the time. Make it count. And make it. Hold Donald Trump accountable. There's going to be a tax cut. Most poor people don't have any federal tax liability. So, you know, demand universal health care, maybe. Or veterans, or something. But hold him accountable now that he won. Which is something that black people did not do with President Obama. Even though they made the difference both times. And if you hold people accountable and demand something, they'll respect you more as well. I have nothing further. I've held you longer, I think. It's 2:25. Mr. Christensen, shall we close it out? Thank you. Thank you.